Good morning. I'm Bruce Silverman, and today I'm going to be talking with Janine Blaylock, director of the Western Lands Project, formerly the Western Land Exchange Project, in Seattle. We're going to talk about the transfer of public land to private owners. And at the end of the program, we'll give you information so you can contact Western Lands Project or find out more information. Janine, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks very much.
The U.S. government owns much of the land in the West. Some people want to give, sell, or trade it away. What's wrong with that?
Well, it can be a good thing in some cases, but what we've found over the years, we've been covering the issue for about 12 years, is that there are a lot of transactions where the public really loses out. The public land agencies are authorized to trade land to private entities if it's in the public benefit and if we get something in return that better serves the public. And there are fairly detailed regulations governing this process. What we found early in the work of our organization was that the regulations weren't being followed very well, and a lot of these transactions where we were trading land to timber companies or developers or mining companies were in fact very harmful to public land and to the public interest.
Well, let's just get a handle on the size of this. How much land is owned by the federal government?
Hundreds of millions of acres. 60% of Idaho is public land, 63% of Utah, 40% of Arizona, and 83% of Nevada.
In Oregon, it's just under 27%. In Washington, just over 27%. And we're talking mostly about U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, is that right?
That's correct.
But also some national parks and defense and some other agencies.
Exactly.
In other countries, does the national government own the land?
There are similar arrangements in other countries, and we've found that countries all over the world have disputes similar to ours over public land, where you have citizens who are very upset about the government's policies of turning over public lands to private interests and wishing to preserve more of that land.
Sometimes the ownership stays in government hands, both in other countries and here, but the use of the lands for oil and gas production or logging or ranching or other profit-making enterprises, sometimes that is leased out and the ownership stays.
That's right, and that has been the source of many disputes over public lands because the general policy in the United States since the public lands became a big issue and there was more of a drive to save some of them, the policy has generally been that multiple use would be the policy overarching all of the land, and that meant that mining companies, oil and gas exploration companies, ranchers, and other users of the land could lease lands for usually 10 years at a time to exploit resources. So this creates a huge conflict because you have interest groups wanting to maximize exploitation, and then of course you have other citizens who want to be able to hike on the lands and use them for more peaceful means and also to know that ecologically the land is being preserved. So this has always posed a very vociferous conflict.
Well, let's go back in history a little bit. How did the U.S. government come into ownership of these lands, for those who don't remember their lessons in elementary school?
Well, when the United States was formed, basically all of the land belonged, I say that in quotes, to the U.S. government. Of course, we know there were other people here before the Europeans came. But over time, the government's policy was to dispose of the land and to give it out to private parties and also to reward political constituents over time to develop the land and to encourage people to expand further and further out onto the continent. So there was a very determined effort over many years and decades to push people out into the hinterlands and bring development and use to the land and to privatize it. such that by the early 1800s, about 70% of the land in the United States had become private.
Well, have the original goals been achieved?
Well, I guess you would say if maximum development were the goal, we have been very close to that, and we continue to push at the edge of it. We have a lot of public land left, hundreds of millions of acres, but a lot of this is being greatly impacted by adjacent development. And then we have an ongoing effort coming mainly from the private sector to privatize more and more of our public land. There's also a whole ideology that states that no land should be in public ownership and that the best status for all land in the country would be for it to be privatized and developed to the maximum. There's another sort of subset of that ideology that says the best way to preserve ecologically important land is to privatize it because private owners will always manage lands more carefully. I tend to disagree with that. I think it's important for us as citizens to have a commons that we share. And the public lands in the United States are really one of the only things that all of us share and all of us have an equal stake in. And I think it has huge ecological value, but I also believe the commons has a very important, it's a very important idea for all of us to share this land. It's the ultimate symbol of democracy.
One part of this history of the U.S. government owning and then dispersing to private hands a lot of the lands, and we're talking mostly about the west, western part of the U.S., the map of these lands turned out to be sort of a checkerboard of 1 square mile sections. Can you just briefly explain how that happened and then why it's problematic now?
One of the parts of the push for development and settlement in the West was to develop the railroads, and the government granted a huge amount of land to the railroad companies for them to construct their rail lines. And I think a familiar example here in the Northwest would be the Northern Pacific Railway, which went from St. Paul to Tacoma, went through the northwestern states. And the way that the railroads were to fund the construction of their lines was to sell off the lands that were granted to them. The U.S., this was under President Lincoln, granted every other square mile of land along the railroad right-of-way to the railroad, and then it extended out from 40 to 120 miles on either side of the railway right-of-way. And that meant we had this checkerboard pattern that covered millions of acres across the northwestern states. This is the same area where the forest reserves, later called the national forests, were overlain. What we ended up having in recent decades was national forests where you could see this pattern. If you flew over it, certainly you could see the checkerboard pattern. Because what happened with those lands eventually from the railway was that they devolved to timber companies that were subsidiaries of the railway, which hastily liquidated the forest on those checkerboards. And so you would often see a pattern of a mile square clear cut followed by a mile square piece of forest that was national forest might be cut or less intensively cut. The problem this created, of course, was that this fragmented ownership also meant fragmented ecological impacts, so that we have a clear-cut area that would greatly impact the adjacent forest, and we wouldn't have a continuous swath of native forest. Instead, we would have heavily, heavily managed checkerboards that didn't provide the kind of habitat and contiguous habitat that was needed for forest creatures.
So you're saying that borderlines, property lines, also paid little or no attention to drainage patterns or anything like that?
That's right. And the timber companies that inherited these lands had much less regulated practices than the Forest Service, and the impact of their cutting was usually much greater.
Were attempts to resolve the checkerboard pattern the main impetus for this exchange program that has developed, or at least at first, were they the main impetus?
It has always been one of the main goals was to consolidate ownership in the checkerboard areas. It really ramped up starting probably in the 80s.
Well, what changed? What other goals became important?
The Forest Service started changing its attitude with the timber wars that began in the 1980s. It became clear that the large-scale clear-cutting that was occurring on national forests was having a huge impact on species and on waterways and on soil and all of the components of the landscape. And the Forest Service was sued many times for breaking the law and associated with the impacts of this clear-cutting, and had to change its attitude over time and start looking at the landscape on a larger scale. So they tried to begin a program of wide-scale ecosystem management. And that meant that you would have to, over time, try to consolidate the ownership on national forests. And so where you had this checkerboard pattern, the logical thing might be to do a land exchange with the timber company that had the clear-cut checkerboards, consolidate federal ownership in one area and do a land trade that consolidated the private ownership in another area. Then the Forest Service, at least theoretically, would have the opportunity to start managing contiguous lands on a landscape-wide scale and provide better habitat and protection of waterways, etc.
It's going to be pretty hard to make sure that the two parcels of land in a proposed trade are of equal value. What kind of problems develop in appraising these values?
What we found was that the Forest Service was trading trees in exchange for clear cuts. We were also getting in return for real forest with trees on it, rocks and ice at high elevation, which would not by any means give us the kind of ecological value of the forest that we were trading away. And there are a lot of problems with the appraisal process. When you start looking at things like the value of the standing timber, we found that the value of timber that we were trading to Weyerhaeuser was just phenomenally underpriced in the appraisal. And one of the things that we also were very concerned about was the fact that we were getting a net gain of hundreds of miles of road. And these are roads built to much lower standards than those on national forest lands, which meant that they were bleeding sediment into streams, that they would have to be decommissioned, which is extremely expensive, and that we as the public would be taking on a huge liability over time in bringing into our ownership these roads that would have to be fixed.
You're suggesting that bureaucrats or maybe their bosses in federal agencies knew darn well that the taxpayers were getting the short end of a trade. Would you say it was intentional politics or incompetence or what?
I don't think that there was real malicious intent, but you have a situation where bureaucrats, and I don't say that as a negative word, I mean these are people who are government employees who I think for the most part try to do a good job, are sitting in a conference room with either lawyers or high-powered officials from, say, a timber company. You know, historically in the Northwest, there's been a tacit understanding that the agencies that manage the public lands are sometimes captive to the very users, such as ranchers and timber companies, that they have to deal with every day. And that they're more likely to cater to the needs of these powerful people who are constantly harassing them for more exploitation and more use of the forest than the citizen who is simply calling for preservation of the forest. There's a power differential there that doesn't really work in the interest of the public.
You're listening to the Morning Radio Zine on KBOO. My name is Bruce, and my guest is Janine Blaylock of the Western Lands Project. We'll give contact information for that organization at the end of the program. Janine, your organization and I think others took some action to try and straighten out the administrative procedures here, try and make things more fair and more on the up and up. When was that?
That was beginning in about 1997, and it really intensified in 98 and 99. We had taken the Forest Service to court. We lost in federal district court, but we took it to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and we won. And the result of that basically was it embarrassed the Forest Service quite a lot. They realized that they were going to have to straighten up their act and and tighten up their land exchange policies and procedures. But it also established that a land exchange cannot simply be treated as a paper transaction, and that it really has impacts on the ground. If you trade a piece of national forest to Weyerhaeuser, the trees are going to be liquidated in a much shorter amount of time than if they stayed under public ownership, because there's just a longer rotation on national forests and there's more strict regulation of forest practices. You have to look at that. You have to look at the impact that it would have, say, on the spotted owl to be trading away native forest. And there were many environmental impacts that just simply were not looked at because the Forest Service had become used to looking at these deals as transactions that only they understood and that only they needed to understand, and that were basically paper trades with no impacts on the ground. We were able, through our lawsuit, to establish that's not the case, and that these need to be treated as major federal actions with potential major environmental impacts. So that has led to a great deal of improvement in the Forest Service's environmental analyses, and I have to say also the Bureau of Land Management, which was the other agency that we started looking at very closely. It's isolated offices and individuals who can cause problems in the procedures. Generally, the policies are greatly improved, but they have to be constantly watched.
So now an environmental impact statement is done whenever the situation calls for it. It may be well done, it may be poorly done, but at least it's done. Suppose something is found, spotted owls are found nesting, or some endangered species, plant or animal, or an area is determined to be of special interest to hikers and those who want to preserve the out-of-doors. There is a way for those who want such a trade to go through, there is a way to go around all the rules, and that is to have a member of Congress write a bill and get a law passed making the trade happen, period. Can you explain that?
One of the advantages to the process, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the law that brings us environmental assessments and environmental impact statements, is that not only do we have an analysis of the potential impacts of a project, but there's a whole structure under that law that provides for public involvement. So that if you and I happen to run across some proposal for a land trade in our favorite national forest, we can get information on it, we can write letters, we can submit input, we can tell the Forest Service that we happen to know there are marbled murrelets living on that part, on one of the parcels. You know, we have a whole structure under that law that enables us to be involved in the decisions concerning our public land through legislation. This has compelled many land dealers to just want to bypass that whole process. And this is the area that I've been concentrating on the most in the last few years, is watching the land deals that go through the U.S. Congress.
Can you give us an example, maybe even one from Oregon or Washington, where someone wanted to make a trade happen quickly or avoid public input or avoid the truth of an environmental impact statement? And what happened?
I think a really good example would be a land exchange proposal that actually failed. It was a proposal by Mr. George Strumpel of Portland, I believe back in 2003. Mr. Strumpel owns a piece of property in the Deschutes National Forest over near Sisters. And back in 2000, there was a wilderness area created on Steens Mountain, and many people had gone in and bought up inholdings on Steens, meaning private pieces of land that were still left over on Steens Mountain, with the intent of later trading those to the government, knowing that with a wilderness area created there, the government would want to acquire those private inholdings.
For a good deal of money.
Yeah, so Mr. Strumpel went in and bought a couple pieces of land on the Steens. And in 2003, he proposed that he trade his parcel on the Steens for a piece of land adjacent to the land he had on the Deschutes National Forest. This was to be done legislatively. It would indeed have allowed him to bypass environmental laws, but in this case, the purported reason for taking it through legislation was that you were dealing with two different public land agencies. There was the Forest Service, which would be giving the parcel to Mr. Strumpel, and there was the BLM, which would be getting the inholding on the Steens. And when there are two agencies involved, it has to go through legislation. Nevertheless, Mr. Strumpel put this proposal together. He was helped by a firm that facilitates land exchanges, that specializes in writing these pieces of legislation. The deal started moving along, and Representative Walden was apparently considering sponsoring a piece of legislation, and all of a sudden it just broke out in the news in the sister's newspaper that this man was proposing to acquire a piece of land on the Deschutes that happened to be a treasured piece of land along Squaw Creek in Sisters. And people in Sisters just went nuts over the idea that they would be giving up this piece of national forest that they love so much and in return be getting an inholding on the Steens, which they couldn't see outside their back window. So there was a huge outcry against this. People started forming a citizens group to fight the exchange. They started writing letters to their members of Congress, discouraging them from sponsoring legislation. And then the Sisters Town Council, to its great credit, called a meeting to allow the citizens to have a hearing on this issue. Even though the town council had no jurisdiction, they wanted to give people a forum. And it was obvious that the public was not going to stand for this. And Mr. Strumpel eventually backed down.
That was an example where public knowledge got in the way of a proposal. But many times, maybe even most times that these bills come up in Congress, the public doesn't know about it, or they don't know about the value of the land or the different values that land might have until it's too late. A lot of these bills wind up being small parts of what they call omnibus spending bills in Congress, where maybe the budget for the whole Iraq war is included, and you know, people in Washington consider it a must-pass law, and then there's a little paragraph at the bottom about some land exchange in the forest, and it just, no one's going to vote against the whole bill because of this, so it goes through.
That's right. It does happen that these bills will end up as so-called riders on appropriations bills. Often we see them attached as riders to appropriations bills that are for the public land agencies. So that makes them a little less cryptic, but nevertheless, they are unrelated to the issue at hand, and it is one of the ways to expedite these deals. I'd like to say a little more about what's wrong with the congressional process.
Okay, and I want to mention to the listeners, one reason that you and I are talking right now is because you have a new book out called Carving Up the Commons, Congress and Our Public Lands. And again, the author is my guest, Janine Blaylock of the Western Lands Project. Go ahead.
There are numerous things that are wrong with congressional land deals. First of all, you often find that the proponent not only is trying to speed things up, but has actually gone to the public land agency, say the Forest Service, and proposed a land exchange. And the Forest Service has said, you know, we don't think this is a high priority, and we don't think it's in the public interest for us to do this right now. The proponent goes to his or her member of Congress and gets a piece of legislation written either by the member or staff or in some cases by a professional land exchange facilitator. And these bills can have a variety of things wrong with them. They usually bypass the National Environmental Policy Act, meaning there will be no environmental analysis, there will be no public involvement structure provided. There will be no alternatives that can be considered, but just a mandate for this particular land deal. It can also rewrite the appraisal processes so that they can fast-track the appraisals. We've seen land bills where Congress says that it deems the land that it's being traded to be of equal value on either side without having seen any land value information. In other words, Congress is declaring by fiat, one, we want this thing to happen, and two, we believe the lands are equal and we're just saying that. That's that.
Do you dare go so far as to say that people proposing these trades are also contributors to congressional campaigns?
Yes, and it used to be a bigger issue for us to try to make that link, but unfortunately, people are pretty inured to that fact by now, that the people who have access are the people who contribute money.
In your book, Carving Up the Commons, I saw some familiar names. Former Senator Gordon Smith from Oregon was involved in at least one controversial deal, but one that really sticks out here is Democratic U.S. Senator from Nevada, Harry Reid, who has a very powerful position, and he's one of the kings of these deals.
He has had several pieces of legislation passed over the last few years that have earmarked Bureau of Land Management land around Las Vegas to be just sold to the highest bidder. And we're talking about more than 300,000 acres of public land that by his pen has just gone to auction. Of course, this is feeding this huge, sprawling development all around Las Vegas, which is the least sustainable development probably on the planet in terms of water and the fragile desert ecosystem. One of the most powerful people in this country also happens to be a big public land dealer.
How can listeners take action or find more information on this issue?
We have a website, westernlands.org, that has a lot of information about the issue with some fundamentals, has a list of some of the projects that we've worked on over the years, has a lot of information about how citizens can be involved in these projects, how you can watch what the Congress is doing, how you can see what's happening on your local national forest. And we also have some books, Citizen's Guide to Federal Land Exchanges, that's like a primer for someone who wants to try to understand and possibly challenge a land exchange. And then our first book, Commons or Commodity, lays out the fundamentals of what the land exchange programs are and some of the pitfalls.
Actually, your latest book, Carving Up the Commons, Congress and Our Public Lands, is available on your website. People can download the entire 106-page book if they want to. It's hard to find around here in Portland. Maybe I'll donate the copy you gave me to the Multnomah County Library.
That sounds like a great idea.
Okay. Janine Blaylock of the Western Lands Project, thank you very much for joining us on KBOO.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.